Well, good evening and welcome to the 10th and last lecture in the Miliband series on economic globalization and global governance. Last but not least, of course, for several reasons. Certainly not last and least because we have two very eminent guests this evening. And last not least because the topic is absolutely central and often underrepresented in discussions about globalization, global economic change, global governance, economic and political reform, and so on. And yet, who can dispute the fact that it is absolutely central theme, globalization and gender? And I'm certainly much looking forward to this evening. Those of you who were here last week and heard Narina Hertz speak also heard my introduction, so I shall be slightly briefer in what I say about her. But let me just fill in something of the background. Narina is an author, academic, and broadcaster. She's Associate Director of the Center for International Business at the University of Cambridge, and she began her career as a Russia expert and worked for the World Bank in 1992, advising the Russian government on a package of economic reforms, including a fairly aggressive package of economic reforms involving privatization, deregulation, and so on. In the mid-1990s, she worked in the Middle East, in the Middle Eastern peace process, with the Palestinian Authority and the governments of Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. With the publication of The Silent Takeover, Narina Hertz became a leading commentator on economic globalization. And you may have read her op-ed pieces and articles in various newspapers from the Washington Post to The Guardian. She's a broadcaster on television and radio. And if you had your radio on this morning, you might have heard the name Narina Hertz on Women's Hour. And Narina and Anne did a brief preview of tonight's talk and exchange. Narina is currently a visiting Miliband fellow here at the LSE, and we're very, very pleased to have her. She's talking tonight, as it suggests here, on the crucial theme of women on the edge, globalization, and gender. Now, when Narina's finished, Anne Phillips is going to respond to her for a few minutes, and Anne probably doesn't need much of an introduction, because those of you who are at the LSE know that Anne is the head of the Gender Institute here. She's a professor in the school in gender theory, and she's also, for those of you inside and outside school, you probably don't need reminding of this, the author of many, many books, including really path-breaking books, Engendering Democracy and Which Inequalities Matter, books that have been very influential across the debates, not just in gender and gender theory, but in political theory and political philosophy as well. As I said, this is the last in the series on economic globalization and global governance, which began with Joe Stiglitz giving the longest lecture I've heard for a long time. You might remember, if any of you came to that, it lasted an hour and a half. And my private comments to the chair at the moment that we should end the lecture after an hour and a half, unfortunately, were broadcast to the overflow rooms. So some of you have probably heard me rather embarrassingly say, this has gone on too long, we must stop it. But in one of the overflow theatres, at least they clapped at that point. Well, last time, Narina was perfect. She talked for 15 minutes, finished exactly on time, fielded 29 questions, which was too much to ask anyone to do. But we'll stick on schedule and hope to create lots of time for you to ask questions after Narina's spoken and after Anne has spoken in response. It just remains for me to say that this is the last in the series, but next term, in January, we're starting an entirely new series of public lectures for the year on American power in the 21st century. I hope it will be just as outstanding as this has been. We've got some of the best commentators on these issues coming from all over the world. It wouldn't be interesting to have a public lecture series just with European and American commentators. So we have scholars coming from China, Latin America, the Middle East as well. So it will truly be a multi-regional, multicultural, multi-perspectival view on the nature, shape, role of America in our century. All right, so will you join with me this evening to welcome Narina?
Thank you, David, for your introduction. And I'm really delighted and encouraged to see so many people here today for a talk on the subject of gender and globalization. It's really great to see just how much interest there is in this subject. I mean, basically a full house. And for those of you who might be wondering why I did decide in this, my second Miliband lecture, to focus on the issue of gender and globalization. I did so really for three reasons. First, I grew up in an arch-feminist home, and I think my late mother would have been very proud that I decided to turn to matters of globalization. Second, in all my travels over the past few years, in Central and South America, in Africa, in Asia, I became more and more aware that it was women who seemed to be bearing the brunt of globalization. And third, because despite this seeming reality, in all the illustrious meetings I've attended and participated in over the past year, at the World Economic Forum meeting in February in New York, at the World Trade Organization, in meetings with trade union activists, with political activists, in debates with government ministers or academics, all on the subject of globalization, the subject of women or gender was never raised at all. Apart from one time over the past year, that is, when the subject of women did come up, and that was in a debate that I had with the Dutch Minister of Development, Evelyn Herfkens, when she asked me something which so disturbed me at the time that I have decided to focus on it in my talk today. And what she said to me was this: surely it's better that women are exploited rather than excluded. This was in connection with women working in sweatshops in third world countries, a question that's very much in line with comments made by economists like Jeffrey Sachs or Paul Krugman. Surely abusive working conditions are better than no job at all. Or to quote Jeffrey Sachs, writing in the New York Times, there are too few sweatshops. Questions and statements which in fact pretty much represent the orthodox neoliberal position, and which I will argue are not only unacceptable, but actively dangerous. For by framing the debate about women working in sweatshops in this way, they implicitly legitimize exploitation and implicitly accept as a given the bad lot that women are being asked to make the best of. Well, I will argue that it is not. And the structure of my talk is as follows. I'll begin by questioning the assumptions that underlie Herfkens, Sachs, Krugman et al., and end with my thoughts on the steps we need to take to change the context in which women make these choices, steps that bear upon IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization policies, but also upon human rights, labor rights, and civil rights more generally. But first, what motivates these statements by Krugman, Herfkens, Sachs et al.? Well, primarily the following. A belief that low-cost labor is a necessary stepping stone in the path towards successful development. With the success of the Asian Tigers between 1960 and 1990, often held up as proof, they used, the argument goes, low-cost labor, and so it's something that fosters development. A belief, of course, perfectly consistent with the standard neoliberal position that promises that in time, wealth will trickle down. With market expansion, benefits will come, wages will rise, and so on and so forth. And presumably it was a desire to follow this kind of trajectory that at least partially led many developing countries to focus on export-oriented growth as the path to development, as well as, of course, a need to generate foreign exchange, to repay debt. The active promotion of these policies by the international financial institutions like the World Bank or the IMF, an increased dependence on foreign investment to provide domestic employment, and a belief that the best chance to attract it was to exploit the only advantage that they had, low-cost labor. And a belief such as this that underlies the focus on export industries as engines of growth in much of the developing world. industries in which women now make up the majority of the labour force. 90% of the Bangladeshi 90% of the Bangladeshi garment industry, for example, 1.2 million workers are women aged below 25. Women rather than men, because they command even lower wages, but also because they are seen as more docile, more adaptable to boredom and repetitive tasks, less likely to complain, rise up, or engage in trade unionism. A belief such as this, which has led to the setting up of over 2,000 export processing zones all over the developing world, zones in which foreign-owned or foreign-subcontracted companies are located, in which, again, most of the workers are female, and in which, on the whole, conditions are pretty bad. There's much evidence of sexual harassment, of women being body searched or even strip searched by male guards as they leave the factory premises, of long working hours and forced overtime, habitual underpayment of wages and unsafe physical working conditions. A study of Mexican maquiladoras, for example, revealed that only 21% of women used protective glasses and 26% gloves, even though 64% of these women were exposed to toxic chemicals for over 6 hours every single day. Of women being vulnerable to exorbitant rents imposed by employers for accommodation, of workers' opinions being monitored and controlled, sometimes through active repression by guards or police forces, of women needing written permission to use toilets and being limited in the frequency and duration of visits, of women being fired with no recourse once they reach their mid-30s because of the preferences for young women by employers, of the formation of unions in China, in the Philippines, in Indonesia and elsewhere being either forbidden by law or in practice impossible to form. As a young woman who I interviewed in the sweatshops of San Pedro Sula said to me, "Conditions here are terrible. They take away our wages and holiday time whenever they feel like it. We are paid no overtime. We are hit and shouted at. The factory owners have carte blanche to do what they like." But maybe Sachs and Krugman and Herfkins et al. Are right. And this just is the path to development, however unsavory it may seem. Maybe sweatshops and exploitation, the prohibition of unions and so on, are just the necessary hurdles we must pass in order to reap the rewards further down the line. Well, I might have bought this argument if I could have been convinced that the following held true. One, that the East Asian miracle could be solely explained by the tiger's ability to rely on low-cost labour. Two, that a focus on low-cost labour and minimal labour standards is a viable long-term development strategy. And three, that such a strategy meets fundamental requirements for justice and equity, both now and in the future. But I am not convinced of any of the three. First, any attempt to explain the East Asian success story up until the 90s by the tiger's ability to rely on low-cost labour completely ignores the fact that a major factor in the Asian tiger's success was that they benefited from United States investment and aid during the Cold War, which of course is not replicable today. And also that their governments highly intervened with protectionist and directionist policies that simply would not be allowed in today's free trade regime. Second, any belief that low-cost labour could be a sustainable long-term development strategy in itself is clearly misguided. By focusing on low wages as a source of competitive advantage, countries become vulnerable
to whichever other countries out there are willing to take an ever lower hit, have even lower wages, even lower labour protection, and so on and so forth. Countries that follow this kind of development path without at the same time doing things like providing training and education facilities, investing in the upgrading of infrastructure, moving themselves along the value chain, so to speak, risk becoming not only locked into a race to the bottom, but also remaining trapped in low-tech, low-productivity industries which commit them to the lowest levels of development and are more likely to herald stagnation than sustained growth. Furthermore, by building a development strategy on the back of low-cost, minimally regulated female labour specifically, countries risk hampering their prospects of improving productivity. This is because such a strategy inhibits the building up of the skill base of 50% of the population, women. For of course, if women believe that they can only secure low wages, that they have no prospects in the job market, then they will have little incentive to invest in their own skill development, and parents will have little incentive to send their daughters to school. Given the clear correlation that exists between female schooling and improvements in productivity and economic growth, such a focus on low-cost women's labour will only harm economic sustainability in the long term. Third, even if a case for sweatshops and low-cost labour can be made as a short-term path to export growth, and I think it's true to say that low wages did play a part in the East Asian story, this strategy could never be justified if it meant that, one, the low-cost labourers, sweatshop workers, were discriminated against on the basis of such morally arbitrary characteristics as age, ethnicity, or gender; two, that these workers were not adequately rewarded for the work that they performed; and three, that they were not free agents in accepting the terms of their employment because their situation allowed them no real freedom to choose. All three of these scenarios do prevail. First, the Asian tiger's success in export growth, as is true with export growth elsewhere, was rather than being non-discriminatory, often to a considerable extent predicated upon discriminatory policies in the labour market. With short-term GDP growth in many developing countries positively correlated with low female wages and gender wage inequality. Gender inequalities which have over time persisted or even increased. In Taiwan, for example, we see that women working in export industries may have made small gains initially, but as the industry grew, it was men that got the higher pay, not women. Women remained concentrated at the bottom of the job hierarchy, locked in at relatively low levels of pay and skills, the first to lose jobs in the times of crisis or cutbacks, the last to be rehired. With no compelling evidence at all from studies of other developing countries that within a few years this changes, that women working in sweatshops do, in the absence of state interventions, get richer, do go out and get more education, do move along the development path. Second, in most cases, women are not being rewarded for their work in a way that could be considered in any ways fair. A recent study in the maquillas of San Pedro Sula in Honduras, for example, showed that the wages paid to women workers there do not even cover the basic costs of living. The minimum wage in the maquila is just 50% of the monthly required income for a family of four for basic survival. This excludes expenses on education, health, recreation, and doesn't enable any savings for the future. Furthermore, what we're increasingly seeing in the developing world is a trend towards the casualisation of labour. Women expected to work without contracts, a move towards home-based labour or outdoor work, for which women are paid less than in export processing zones, with no benefits or security at all. Effectively subsidising the rental costs and social protection costs that should be being borne by corporations. In the garment and footwear sectors in Latin America, for example, and Asia, home workers, predominantly women, now represent up to 50% of the labour force. And such expansion of the informal economy has led to a fall in real wages for women in most developing countries. In fact, a recent study of hard data from a decade shows an almost uniform wage meltdown in many developing countries' garment industries. Moreover, even when countries do develop, as the economy moves towards more technologically sophisticated jobs, women's share in jobs in export processing zones falls. The production of technology-intensive items such as car parts and computers in the higher-wage economies of Latin America and Asia, for example, has also been associated with a rise in male labour and very little vertical mobility for women. This bodes ominously not only for women in the countries concerned, but also for their counterparts in poor countries whose prospects of breaking out of the routine manual assembly work are increasingly bleak. Rather than providing women with a clear escape route from poverty, deprivation and discrimination, working in export industries seems to provide them with only very limited improvement on any of these fronts. Add to this the fact that women often have limited control over their own earnings. In Southeast Asia and Cameroon, for example, most women have to hand over their wages to their husbands, threatened by domestic violence if they do not do so. That in those cases in which women do bring in more money than is needed to meet subsistence requirements, the money is typically used for advancing the prospects of sons rather than daughters. And that it isn't the case that by entering the paid economy, women's unpaid work at home decreases at all. And it is clear that in many ways, what we are seeing is a reinforcing of gender stereotypes rather than the breaking of them down. Which isn't to deny, of course, that there are a number of individual cases of women who do benefit from working in export-oriented industries. There are some cases of women's bargaining position in a household improving as their wages approach or exceed those of male workers in the same households. An independent income can sometimes increase women's autonomy in personal matters, such as her choice of spouse, or allow her to delay marriage. Having a job, in some cases, enables women to get out of the home and can provide them with expanded social opportunities and enhanced support systems. And in some countries, even being able to travel to work alone can be empowering. But unfortunately, such positive examples are by and large far and few between. And more often what we see is women, by accepting jobs under sweatshop conditions, trading off a slight improvement in the economic aspects of their impoverished situation for a marked deterioration in their personal integrity, freedom, rights, and self-esteem. Trading off a reduction in poverty in income or expenditure terms for a steady impoverishment of their spirit, confidence, and soul. This raises the question, even if working in these conditions does enable women to better their bad lots in some sort of way, even if some of the women working in these conditions do say that they are glad to have a job rather than no job at all, should we just accept the bad lot, as Sachs et al. Seem to, and maintain the pretense that women are freely making a choice to take up this kind of employment? Or should we admit that the situation in which women find themselves in allows them no real freedom to choose, and try to do something to change the context in which women are making these choices? Surely women wouldn't choose to be exploited or to accept poor work conditions if they had other, better alternatives, if the context in which they were making these choices were different, if they were not being made to choose between, on the one hand, exploitation, and on the other, survival. So what is the context within which women are making these choices, and how can it be changed? Well, the typical macroeconomic environment in which women are making these choices is one shaped by structural adjustment programs, debt obligations, labour market deregulation, and IMF prescriptions. Prescriptions that almost always include advice to reduce wages and lower workers' protection. Bulgaria, for example, was advised in March 2001 by the IMF to maintain wage discipline, in spite of the fact that at $125 a month, Bulgaria has the lowest industrial wage in the whole of Central and Eastern Europe. Uruguay was told in the same month to practice wage moderation at a time that real wages were falling. A lot of work has been done on the negative effects such IMF and World Bank policies and programs have had on women. Public expenditure cutbacks and privatization of social service delivery typically shift more responsibilities onto the shoulders of women, who disproportionately provide the unpaid care on which social reproduction rests. When expenditure on hospitals is, for example, cut, and elderly patients are sent home, it's not assumed that these patients are just going to go home and die. It's assumed that somebody, a woman, is going to take care of them. And when the cost of pharmaceuticals rise because the government has been told or forced to end its subsidies for medicine or food, there is an assumption that the household will take care of these problems too, that women will go back to making traditional medicines and will make their food at home. The implicit assumption is that women will always be there and that their time is infinitely elastic and flexible, that women will scramble to find the additional income to provide some of the missing social services themselves, or will just allow their unpaid workload to increase ever more. Moreover, the macroeconomic policies that governments have to adopt to attract and retain short-term capital, high interest rates, tight monetary policies, and fiscal restraint create a deflationary bias which prevents governments from dealing effectively with recession and has a disproportionate effect on women, who usually have worse access than men to social safety nets. The increased indebtedness of a country leads to a deterioration in girls' enrollment in secondary school education. Pressure on the nation state to reduce public expenditure on education negatively impacts upon female literacy rates, wherever, as we have seen, parents have to choose between sending their sons or their daughters to school. The evidence is pretty compelling, and has been for some time now, that the policies promoted and pushed by the IMF and the World Bank disproportionately increase the burden on women, and so limit the job choices that they make. Add to this the fact that women are all too often making these choices from positions of economic destitution. Of the 1.3 billion people living in poverty, 70% are women. Two-thirds of the women working in the Mexican maquiladora sector at the beginning of the 90s lived in households that needed women's incomes to survive. That women's choices of alternative employment are limited by the fact that they are denied access to education. 130 million girls have no access even to primary education. Of the world's 900 million illiterate people, women outnumber men by 2 to 1. That many women are not allowed to make claims upon the state for social benefits, which must be applied for by their husbands, and that women have limited access to credit, which further limits the prospects of alternative sources of employment. And it's clear that the choices that women are making to work in these sweatshops are being made from positions of great weakness and vulnerability. In the absence of a social safety net, the choice to take a job or not take a job becomes a choice between a bad job and starvation. In the absence of a culture of rights, women often accept unsavory conditions unquestioningly. In the absence of trade unions, a trade-off has to be made between the chance to work and the ability to call for better working conditions. In the absence of childcare options, women may choose to be home-based workers, even though they get lower pay, no benefits, and probably instant termination in economic downturn times. In the absence of an ability to borrow or get credit, women have no choice but to work for others. In the absence of credible, alternative ways of being and doing, women will tend to accept things the way they are. But can things be changed? Well, I'm sure this is something we will discuss more in the discussion period. So for now, let me just wrap up by focusing on just 6 steps that we must push for. First, multinational corporations that buy from export processing zones or sweatshops or subcontract from these facilities must be held accountable for the conditions in which their goods are made. Legislation is needed at a national and regional level to ensure that they disclose in full the names and addresses and locations of factories in which the products they're importing are being made, and that they report the social conditions in which these goods are made. It's just unacceptable that companies are able to hide behind their supply chains on matters of human rights, labour abuses, and blatant gender discrimination and harassment. They must be forced to carry out due diligence in this area in the same way that they would have to ascertain, for example, that no banned chemicals were used by a subcontractee in a product's manufacture. And they must be penalised for breaches of human rights and labour standards and unfair treatment of women workers, for not only by market-based pressures, but by national and international authorities too. Second, the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, must be made to acknowledge that there is a conflict between demands for women's human rights and neoliberal programs that undermine the capacity of governments to discharge their responsibilities to improve the well-being of women, and indeed which often involve the rolling back or even curtailment of economic and social rights. However important the programs that the bank, United Nations and aid agencies currently support, education and training for women, increased access to credit, the microcredit schemes, however many publications on gender issues the bank now publishes, however many gender issues it now highlights in its flagship and mainstream reports, unless the bank and the IMF critically evaluate the impact that their own policies are having, not only on women, but on those most marginalised, these institutions will be continuing to help the situation with one hand and exacerbate it with the other. And it's not more formal declarations of the ilk of the Copenhagen United Nations Social Summit of 1995 that we're looking for, in which it was established that equality and equity between women and men is a priority for the international community. That I'm talking about, it's tangible commitment and real action. Third, other multilateral institutions like the World Trade Organization or NAFTA which are also responsible for shaping the environment in which women operate, must also carry out reviews to assess the impact of their policies on women. This is particularly pressing given recent analyses of trade agreements between the European Union and Latin America, which show that women's economic and social rights to fair payment, just working conditions, social and health security, etc., have come under increasing pressure thanks to the trade agreements, and also that their political rights, such as the rights to organise unions, have also been in decline. But analyses ex post are not all that is needed. The proposed expansion of the WTO's remit under the General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATS, which is likely to result in a hiking up of prices of public utilities and services, acts which we know from prior experience are more likely to put a burden on women, must be actively resisted. Trade policies must be judged on whether they succeed in terms of social justice, not just economics. Fourth, it is essential that women workers, wherever they are, have the opportunity to freely associate so that they themselves can influence the context within which they work, ensure that they are adequately rewarded for the work they perform, and strive to make sure that gender inequalities at work are torn down. This right must be enforced on an international basis. Otherwise, as we see time and time again, multinationals will relocate to where the workers are not so well organised. Moreover, trade unions from the north must recognise themselves the need to work internationally and to take on cross-border campaigns. And the International Labour Organization, the ILO, and the International Confederation of Trade Unions are now doing these kind of things. But the right to freely associate is only the starting point. Trade unions need to think much more creatively about how to increase the level of female participation in the South. Work needs to be done on mobilising women in the informal economy, for example, and much more thought given on how to best cater to the needs of women, given the limited time they have to participate in union activities because of conflicting family responsibilities, given that the issues that concern them, like sexual harassment, health, education needs, may fall outside the traditional collective bargaining remit of a trade union. And more efforts must be made to break the macho culture of trade unions in the South. In Sri Lanka, for example, in spite of the relatively large proportion of female trade unions, women only hold 3% of the union executive positions. In Australia, to give you some sense of comparison, we're talking about 25%. Fifth, we must acknowledge that women's rights at work cannot be separated from their rights as equal citizens. Look at the levers that helped women to improve their status and condition in Europe and North America. Universal suffrage, anti-discrimination laws, public education and health services, the welfare state, inheritance, pensions, life insurance to the spouses, divorce and child support rights and payments, equal rights with men to economic resources, not just labour rights in factory production. Very little will be achieved by ending discrimination at work if women are denied the right to education or childcare facilities, nor by bringing about equal pay if women have no right to control their earnings. And women's organisations have a clear role to play here by working with women to teach them not only about their labour rights, but about their civil, economic and human rights more generally. And sixth and finally, we have to convince policymakers in developing countries that exploitation does not foster long-term economic growth, and that rather than being at odds with economic sustainability, a positive relationship between equity and sustainability may often exist. Even the World Bank, in its 2001 publication, Engendering Development, provides evidence that gender inequalities impose costs and diminish an economy's capacity to grow and raise living standards. Countries that blinkeredly focus on low-cost female labour are likely to therefore find themselves locked in at low levels of development, desperately having to play catch-up with countries invested in technology, supportive human resources policies, and women's education. Gendered policies are therefore needed to improve overall productivity and efficiency. This means ensuring not only that girls have equal access to education as boys and so become more productive members of society, but also ensuring that anti-discrimination policies, equal opportunity programs, equal pay for equal work policies are in place so as to make it worthwhile for women to invest in education, because by so doing, they could actually better their long-term job prospects. And evidence suggests that even cultural inhibitions can be overcome if economic incentives for women for acquiring education are strong enough. These are just six possible steps to take to address the context within which women are making these job choices. And I don't underestimate the difficulties taking each of them will entail. Each step threatens the interests of entrenched elites and challenges accepted orthodoxies. Each step will demand real political will and moral imperative to go through with. But unless the context within which women choose their employment is understood and addressed, and unless the paucity of a development strategy based on low-cost sweat labour is acknowledged, the question, but isn't exploitation better than exclusion, will still be seen to be an acceptable one. We cannot let this go on. For reasons of economic sustainability, but even more so, for reasons of equity and justice, in economic policy, in political action, and in social commitment too, women on the edge must become women in the centre. Thank you.
Anne Phillips will now respond for a few moments and to raise some issues. Thank you, Anne.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Marina. And I mean, I think the kind of the point that I really kind of value from what you've said there is the way that you're calling on us to sort of challenge that kind of brutal either-or, you know, as if we have to choose between the most exploitative conditions or exclusion, so have to choose between either very low wage, dangerous working conditions, or nothing at all. And the quotes that you began with reminded me very much of the kind of discourse that happened in Britain in the 1970s, at the time when equal pay legislation was being introduced, where, again, people kind of came out with this notion that, women, could insist, if they chose to, on having equal pay with men, but they'd better realise that if they did that, that there would be very few employers around who were still prepared to give them a job. And similar kinds of arguments also surfaced in relation to minimum wage legislation. So that kind of, that brutal either-or, either you accept these conditions or you'll have nothing at all, is something that I think we do have to resist, and I think the kind of suggestions you make go a long way towards that. But I also kind of find the kind of picture you draw a bit kind of one-dimensional. If you take the kind of the East Asian tigers, which you sort of refer to as examples of low-wage development. I mean, it seems to me very hard to describe those countries as premised on low-wage development these days. In fact, there's been an enormous kind of investment in the skilling of the labour force in the Asian tigers, and it's very clear from, in fact, the students who end up at LSE that girls as well as boys have benefited from the investment in education which has taken place there. I mean, women, as everywhere, have benefited less than men, but they have benefited too. And I think, I mean, that links to the kind of, I suppose, the main thing that I want to say, which is, you know, in a way, it seems to me that what you say doesn't sufficiently take on the scale and the significance of the changes that have happened in the global economy over the last 30 years. I mean, it seems to me that the, you know, the global incorporation of women into the labour market is, you know, is probably the single most significant social change that has occurred through that period. And it's happened in the ways you described. It happens through women being employed at very low wages in export processing zones. It's happening through women being employed in sweatshop conditions, in contracted out, in sort of contracted out conditions. But it is something that has happened. It's provided many women with access to an independent income. It means that they have a basis from which to challenge the power of fathers and husbands. And it's been linked with what I think has also been one of the major phenomena of the last 20 years, which is a major mobilisation around women's human rights. I don't think anyone should minimise the exploitation associated with these developments, but we shouldn't at the same time ignore the way that it has changed and is changing gender relations. I suppose, in other words, I'm saying I think there's much more transformation and contestation going on around gender issues throughout the world than, in a sense, is the kind of picture that one gets from what you say. And that kind of relates to a sort of further thing that I wanted to pick up on, that there's a sense in which the devil in your picture is very much it's the transnational corporations, it's the international institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization. And in my reading, actually, the devil in many ways lies in local and domestic forces, which include, of course, movements and indeed governments, which, you know, through a kind of rhetoric of anti-Westernization or anti-globalization, in many ways act to increase the constraints on women, you know, so actually excluding women from education or employment or, enforcing women's seclusion in the home, reinforcing patriarchal controls over women's sexuality. I mean, the transnational institutions aren't angels, but in a sense they have less invested in the subordination of women. They like the cheap labour, of course, you know, but at another level, they don't give a damn about whether women submit to their fathers or their husbands in the home or veil themselves or mobilise for political and social power. In a sense, that's not their particular project. So, I mean, one of my concerns is whether, in one sense, the kind of the focus on transnational organisations can be misleading, that maybe in a sense, you know, if you're speaking from, you know, from the West, you maybe focus on these because you see yourselves, probably falsely, as having more potential leverage on them. But I think that the women on the edge that you're describing, in many ways, they're most immediately engaged in contestations within their own families, within their local communities, and with their own national governments. So in a sense, that's kind of one of the questions that I just wanted to pose to you, as to whether the kind of, you know, the problems that you're identifying, in a sense, are kind of, are sort of, you're exaggerating the sense in which it's kind of, it's primarily through the kind of the international and transnational elements, and underplaying the sense in which the gender contestations are actually very much bound up with local and domestic forces.
Thank you, Anne. Nina, do you want to come speak to these issues first?
Yeah, I'll do that.
So more contestation going on, more transformation going on, and the devil is less global and more local.
Okay, Anne, you gave me a few challenging points to deal with. On the point of the East Asian Tigers' success, I think what we see is that education played a big part when we really look at what the East Asian success was about, primary and secondary education, and that kind of differed from some of the other countries. But I think we've got to be very clear that in places like Taiwan or South Korea, women are not reaping the benefits of the success in any way that could be seen as kind of proportionate, that gender inequalities have actually grown and continue to grow in this period. In South Korea, women earn 45% of men's wages on average. On your point about the scale, you know, the fact that women are just entering the workforce is this kind of huge event. Absolutely, I mean, it is. And the challenge really facing us is how do we ensure that this is something that adds to women's well-being and not just men and various elites in society. So I think that's the challenge facing us. I don't want national governments to be let off the hook. And I think you're right that this is a constituency that has a real role to play here. But I think we mustn't underestimate the pressure that these governments are on to attract foreign investment, for example, especially because foreign overseas aid to developing countries has fallen by 45% in real terms since 1990, given the fact that they're competing with other countries out there who are also trying to get their labour force to work. And so, you know, countries have, a lot of these developing countries, of course, have labour laws that should protect women and women's rights, but they're not enforcing these laws. And so there are projects going on right now with the ILO, for example, which is working with Bangladesh on helping Bangladesh work out how, in this kind of globally competitive world, it can enforce its labour laws and not lose its global position. So just a few thoughts on your comments.
Okay, so now we open up to you. But the first thing he says, thank you. I was going to say, let there be light, for the first time in my life, and there was light before I even said it. So just a few things on questions. We'll take them in clusters of five. Could you stand up when you ask a question, please? Last time we had difficulty knowing where the question was coming from. If you don't mind, that would be very helpful. And finally, if you're thinking of leaving in the next 10 minutes, can you do so now, before questions start? Because last time, the slow trickle. I don't want there to be a rush to the doors here, but just if you are thinking of going because you're hungry, go now. And then we can have question and answers for 20 minutes in a fairly undisturbed way. Thank you. Okay. Questions and fives. Yes, question up in the center there. Where are the mics? Thank you.
Hi. I think it was very interesting that your the focus of your analysis was very much on third world women in their third world home countries, whereas, of course, the flow of women around women workers and female labour around the globe is an important aspect of this of their entry to the work to the workforce. So I wonder if you want to talk a bit more about migrant women who end up being exploited just as much in Western countries, whether it's as domestic labour for middle-class women or whether it's as prostitutes. So I'd just like to hear your views on that.
Thank you. Any more questions at the top before we... Yes, please.
You said about the South Korean women right now, about that they earn something like 45% of the wages.
45.
Yeah, and I was just wondering, I mean, I don't know if, first of all, I don't know if that is the like the minimum wage. Is that what we are talking of? And if that, I mean, I understand from Ms. Phillips that it is here, the minimum wage act is, so everybody earns the same. What I want to know is, when you go to any corporations here in Europe, I don't know about America, but there is a huge discrepancy between what managers earn here as women as compared to what men earn. So is that also an issue?
Camera, a camera. Mic over there, please. Well, there's a camera over there. I guess that's why I said it. Thank you.
Hi. It's a really short question. Yes. Do you think that women in Latin America haven't changed their labor position based on the Marianista culture?
Two more before we go back. Sorry to bring you around.
Thanks very much for your talk. Not one-dimensional at all. I just something which didn't figure on your list of positive steps, which I wanted to get a reaction from you for, was the idea that maybe by not purchasing some goods, I might limit foul practices and transgression of workers' rights. I wonder whether you thought that was a good idea. And if you did think that was a good idea, wouldn't that imply that, since we're not taking questions straight, answers straightly afterwards, that the follow-up to that is, if you did think that was a good idea, wouldn't that imply that participation was better than exclusion?
Okay, there's one question just here. Thank you. We'll come back to you.
Thank you, Narina. Can you comment on the role of religion in gender inequality?
Okay, that's five questions. We'll come. There'll be other clusters in a moment. So, Narina, do you want to speak to the five, and then Anne will have an opportunity to add something?
Sure. You raised a very important point about the issue of migrant female workers, whether in the sex trade or working as domestics, and that was something which I actually, when I was working out what I wanted to talk about today, it was a whole area that I thought I might want to address, and then I realised the lecture was big enough as is. But this is obviously a huge problem, women are kind of far away then from their local home support systems. But that's something we also see in the export processing zones, where women are often coming from rural areas and moving into towns, being put up in dormitories and far away from their own kind of social networks as well. But it's a huge area with, you know, terrible, even kind of worse stories than the stories I've looked at, and, you know, very germane to this argument. Is there a discrepancy between male and female wages at all levels, or are we talking just about a kind of discrepancy at the minimum wage level? What we're seeing is that there's a discrepancy, there's gender inequality of wages at all levels. But just as we move in the same way here, as we move higher up the employment scale, we also see kind of less and less women in those positions in the first place. So we're seeing, yes, we haven't done that well here in developed countries on this front either. The question about the extent to which culture, I think is really what you were getting at, the extent to which the kind of dominant male culture in Latin America is responsible for women not changing. I mean, definitely culture plays a part in all of this. There are cases, of course, of women in maquiladoras forming groups together, teaching each other about human rights, kind of despite the macho culture, uniting and doing things. But, you know, it's institutionalized discrimination coming from a variety of fronts, which is another factor, of course, that women have to contend with. The question about, you raise, a very valid question, which is really, what can we as individuals, is there something we as individuals can do about all of this? And, if we just boycott a product that we think is made in a sweatshop, is this a positive thing to do? Well, I think we do see the impact that we can see the impact that Western kind of consumer pressure has on companies' behaviour by the fact that there's an increasingly marked difference now between exploitation by local firms and exploitation by foreign firms. And the foreign firms are actually paying, on average now, the big branded multinationals higher wages and trying to provide better conditions. These are the branded Western producers, because of the fear that their reputation is going to be so tainted, like Nike's was, like Walmart's clothing range was in America, over this issue of exploitative female labor. So not voting with your wallet is something that can be effective, but of course it's very hard to actually know which companies are doing what. And when I was speaking on this subject really last week, and one of the things I told people was, when I went to the protest in Genoa and I had to buy a new pair of sneakers, and I went to the sports goods shop and I saw kind of an array of brands, and I thought, well, I don't want to buy Nike because I kind of know what Nike does, but I don't know where Adidas is making its products, or Reebok, or the brands that I'd never even heard of. So acting as a kind of consumer activist is predicated upon having sufficient information, really, to make this valid. And religion, you know, in a way, kind of follows on from the culture question. I mean, of course, religion and culture do have real and significant impacts on perpetuating and reinforcing gender stereotypes and gender inequality. And you know, a bit of what Anne was saying is that, you know, part of what we're seeing is this, you know, in some cultures, this kind of backlash against globalization with this kind of re-entrenchment of cultural and religious norms that could actually be particularly discriminatory against women. But we also have to remember that in each of these countries, we also see cases time and time again of women rising up against it, of women trying to fight against the burden of these traditions.
Oh, yeah. Should I just say something on the minimum wage question? I mean, I think when minimum wage legislation is introduced, it always has particularly kind of favourable consequences for women. I mean, in Britain, say, women minimum wages are set at just over £4 an hour, and, you know, women being the lowest paid workers in this country as elsewhere, you know, about two-thirds of those who benefited from that, the introduction of that legislation, were indeed women workers. But, you know, but the kind of, you know, the pay gap between men and women in Britain remains pretty astonishing, you know, and there are different kind of estimates that you can kind of give depending on whether you do it by hour or whether you include overtime payment, whether you include perks. But, you know, I think, you know, there's a gap of, you know, women are earning around 65% of men in Britain. You know, it's not, I mean, it's a lot better than 45%. But it's,
next cluster. Okay, let's have a mic over this corner a minute. And the two people, I promise you, over there.
Yes, I was wondering about globalization versus capitalism itself, because free market capitalism, I think, is at the very basis of social and economic inequality. It's at the basis of the exploitation itself, and it is always in favor of lower wages. And yet, in your very good talk, you didn't really mention the force of capitalism as opposed to globalization, and whether the reforms shouldn't be really aimed at changing the economic system rather than the global reach of the system.
I wanted to ask you a little bit of a personal question, if that's okay. You've been looking at globalization for some years now, and a whole variety of aspects of it, and I wondered how looking at women in particular over the last however long you've been doing it has changed or opened up new perspectives for you on the question of globalization itself.
Thank you. A couple up there, and then we'll come to the gentleman over there on the right. Yes.
Yes, it seems to me, and for what you said, that there is a connection between the welfare state and more equal access to education, to better wages, etc. So I would like if you can say something else about this connection between the welfare state and gender inequalities. Thank you.
There was a question up there, yes, please.
Yeah, hi. My question is just related to the subjective experience of women in both perpetrating and challenging, their role or their position, given the context of globalization, but it's not only structural, but also the subjective.
Can I raise a point instead of asking a question?
Sorry, where is this question coming from? Or point? Okay.
A brief point.
Brief point, yeah. I think when talking about globalization, most of scholars from the developed world, it seems to me that they have ignored the difference between the developing world and the developed world. The most common mistake they make is they use the established standard in the developed world to look at the problems of the developing world. The second common mistake they make is that they expect the conditions in the developing world to level the developed world overnight. Now, that is not practical. Let me give a simple example.
A short one.
Short one, yeah. last governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, he did a lot of legislation for Hong Kong. He applied all the British standard and value to Hong Kong and expect Hong Kong to level Britain overnight. What happened? Hong Kong was a paradise for work with zero unemployment rate. But now, the unemployment rate in Hong Kong is 7.8%, even higher than the UK. So my point is, to solve all the problems for globalization, we have to first of all recognize the difference. The major factor to solve the problem, it is time. When time comes, they will level the developed world.
Thank you. Well, those are five quite challenging questions, beginning with globalization or capitalism or...
Five very challenging and different questions. Your question was about, I've been framing this debate in terms of globalization being the issue at stake, and you're saying, isn't it really capitalism that's the problem? Shouldn't we be having done with capitalism if we want to see this kind of positive trajectory that I hope for? I think we have to be very clear that there are many things that we're talking about when we talk about capitalism, and that there isn't just this one model of capitalism, the Anglo-American ruthless laissez-faire model, which I think we often talk about, and I would agree with you, then we have a real problem with that particular model. But there are, of course, other variations of capitalism. You know, the European model is different to the American model, which is different again to the Asian model of capitalism. So, I think, and having, thought about this particular issue for some time, I've come to feel that, capitalism seems to be the best system for creating wealth. It seems to have kind of won that argument hands down. But there's nothing in capitalism itself which deals with how this wealth is redistributed, nor that ensures that the costs engendered in the wealth creation are not unacceptably high in terms of environmental degradation, in terms of human rights, in terms of all of that. So I guess I'm a reformist at heart rather than a revolutionary. So I believe that there are ways that we can reform this very extreme model of capitalism that we now have in order to reach to this more equitable world. The question about how has looking at women in really now kind of shaped my thoughts and informed me and influenced me. I found this whole experience when I decided to, after writing The Silent Takeover, what I realized as I was writing it was that a lot of the cases I was looking at, a lot of the stories I was looking at were actually women, but I hadn't actually focused on the issue of women before. And I found this whole process, subsequent process of really going through the academic literature on women and really looking at these issues through a gendered lens. It's almost like this veil has been kind of lifted from me. And, and I realize it's so clear. Once you start looking at these issues in gender terms, it's so clear that women are disproportionately being affected. And, I guess my kind of personal commitment to myself moving forward with my academic work is to make sure that I do not, forget the fact that looking at these issues through a gendered lens actually is valuable and important. On the question of the welfare state and the relationship between having a welfare state and women's empowerment, I mean, there's absolutely, I'm compelled by the evidence that having a state that will support women, families, households has a clear relationship and clear bearing on women's outcome. So whether it is things like ensuring that women can have access to social security payments and don't have to go through their husbands, whether it's things like childcare, for women. I mean, that's still an issue here of course, as well. Whether it's things like the state providing education, because as I explained in my talk, when families have to choose between sending their sons or daughters to school, they will send their sons. Things like the privatization of public utilities, water, which has now been privatized in some developing countries, and now means that women have to trudge for kind of 10 miles to go and get clean, safe drinking water on top of working in one of these sweatshops and looking after their family. So these things have huge bearings. On the question of, you asked a question of, I think it was about, are women, are there cases of women kind of challenging these issues themselves? There are cases of women being, of women's empowerment, of women kind of at small grassroots levels doing things. There are cases in Kenya, for example, of a group of women who've managed to get a mediation court set up in a village whereby they can take their husbands there if they've been beating them up at home, and there's some kind of structure now to deal with domestic violence. There are kind of various grassroots organizations. But what I realized was that these were actually very far and few between and very fragmented. And I think that's because of the fact that, you know, women are essentially finding it very difficult to rise up because, you know, they're not allowed to form unions, because they're illiterate, because they've got to look after the whole family as well as work, because they don't have the time, because they're trudging 10 miles so for water. So it's all of these factors, I think, are disabling women from rising up in greater and greater numbers. And then there was the point that the gentleman over there made about needing to, you know, about developed countries having this kind of arrogance that they can just impose their one-size-fits-all strategies and standards on developing countries. I think that's a completely astute comment. And, you know, I cut my teeth on all this in Russia, where I was, after I went to business school, I was working for the World Bank, advising the government on its privatization program. And that was exactly what we were doing. We were just taking a kind of Western model of markets and imposing it on Russia, expecting, I mean, it sounds very naive now, but expecting within a few years something like America to emerge out of Russia. And of course, it couldn't and didn't and was never going to. And it shows no understanding of the institutional kind of basis of an economy and of a society and of the relevance that history and culture and all of these things have in a country's development. But I think, on the other hand, I would say just kind of waiting, you know, is probably not the right strategy. I think there are actual decisions that governments can make that can foster growth and development, investing in education and infrastructure. The difference that developing countries could have if, for example, the poorest countries' debt obligations were cancelled. I mean, there's a whole host of things that national governments, international institutions can actually do to make the trajectory, I think, better.
Can I just add something on this last question, the question of time? I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, there are very difficult issues associated with, you know, whether norms and policies and regulations that have become established in the richest countries of the world, you know, can simply be imposed on, required of countries elsewhere. I think there are very complicated issues around child labour, for example, you know, where, you know, sort of banning child labour could actually mean that entire families fail to survive. There are very complicated issues around environmental regulation, which can simply drive entire industries out of business. And, you know, as I say, very complicated issues. But it seems to me, and this I think is entirely in the spirit of what Narina is saying, that it would be very unfortunate if we treated issues regarding women and gender inequality as kind of luxury concerns that countries can only begin to address once they reach a particular kind of level of wealth. And I think that really shouldn't be the way in which we approach these questions.
There's just 10 minutes left. So five brief questions, perhaps no longer than a sentence each, capable of being answered with a yes or a no, because we have to limit the platform from speaking for too long as well. So brief questions, no semicolons, no colons allowed. One sentence, please.
I just wanted to, well, I guess it is a question on whether or not the wealth of the developed nations is dependent on the impoverishment or the continued impoverishment of developing nations, and whether or not historically, not that I'm advocating exploitation rather than exclusion, but does history tell us that that has what has happened through the centuries? We have England, the Industrial Revolution. We have the U.S. and not even low wage, but no wage labor over several centuries. And is this the route we want to continue? Can capitalism support equality and live?
Thank you. Another question up there? Yes, please.
In economies that are very bad, don't you think that the reason why men may have a backlash towards women is because they have a lack of control? And it's not necessary, and they're just kind of taking it out on women, and it's not necessarily entirely due to religion or culture.
Thank you. We'll just take one more question from the top and then two down here. Yeah.
Hi, I was just wondering if in all this work that you've done looking at women in the global workforce, if you've ever met any resistance from these women themselves in terms of what you're trying to do to better their conditions, perhaps because rocking the boat for them would mean they're losing their job. I'd be interested to know just myself.
Thank you.
I was wondering whether you could comment on the inequalities amongst women within the same country. It's a very Marxist argument to make, but have you found any evidence as to how globalization affects different classes of women within the same country?
I think we have to take that gentleman's
question. Yes, no, he's next on the list.
Okay.
And then we'll take one more over here, and that's it, because that'll be six.
Okay, I want to say I believe you're absolutely right in all the examples you've provided, but everything you've mentioned affects men working under appalling conditions in poor countries also. The sweatshops provide a good example, but a man in Indonesia building and lacquering furniture for the West is provided no more safety equipment than a woman in those sweatshops. The prescriptions you provide, holding multinationals to account, acknowledging human rights violations, making multinationals assess their impact, exploitation, not fostering long-term growth. These are all perhaps more geared towards globalization and exploitation of poor countries in general. Could you please clarify for me how this affects women and in particular, but I want to add on one last thing, I'm sorry. You made a reference to Bulgaria and the IMF's policy of freezing the wages at $125 a month.
Recommending
that they be frozen at $125 a month. That's valid, but that was also valid for men. The only reason why that affected women more in the country than men is because Bulgaria is a country that has a higher population of women that are in the workforce.
Okay, thank you. Finally, the last question of the night. So far, it's been more like a paragraph each than a sentence. but we have a moment.
I am personally from Bulgaria, but I don't want to rise develop the discussion now. It will take a long time. And I have a very concrete question. Do you think that the gender mainstreaming approach will reduce in one way and another the negative effect of globalization? Or you think that this negative effect is spread only in so-called developing countries? Thank you.
That's it. Then, Narina, 3 minutes.
Thanks. The point that the lady over there raised about aren't we just seeing essentially rich countries exploiting kind of poor countries, and isn't this what we've always seen? Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent you're absolutely right. The North is exploiting the South to generate wealth. The trouble is that the South is kind of exploiting itself, exploiting its own resources, exploiting its human resources, particularly female labor, in a kind of self-defeating strategy. And so I think that's what we need to, that's what needs to be addressed. I think, is this compatible with, can capitalism support equity and equality and live? I think it can. I think I think evidence is clear that over time, that long-term kind of growth is actually not predicated upon terrible working conditions, no education, et cetera, et cetera. But that all of these factors actually do enable a country to develop long-term. The question about... the question over here was about men. I think it was over there somewhere. Men are men are kind of losing control. Men are feeling very disempowered, and that's perhaps why they're that's why they're kind of rising up against women, rather than, you said, rather than kind of religion or culture. But I think religion and culture probably do play a part in why is it women who are being kind of, why is one group being singled out in this kind of path? Of course, poverty, of course, instability, of course, a general feeling of lack of control. These are all things that break down inequality, just break down a kind of sense of social cohesion in general, and so will impact upon the most vulnerable groups in society. But we have to ask ourselves, why is it time and time again women, and why are we not doing something or enough about it? The question about inequalities amongst women, the point that you raised, the point that you raised, Aisha, about are we seeing inequalities amongst women? There's definitely a class factor at play here. There's an education factor. There's an age factor. We see differences when we look, when I look at women along those dimensions. Yes, we do see differences. We see kind of rich, educated women having very different futures to the poor, uneducated, illiterate women out there, and it is important to bring class and education into a kind of wider analysis. On your point about men working in, this also affects men, of course, this is really an attack on exploitation of exploitation of men as well as women, an attack on exploitation of those most vulnerable in our society. And but why I felt that there was a clear kind of gender element to this was just that women are so disproportionately making up the labour force in these export-oriented industries. 70-80% of export-oriented industries in most developing countries are women workers, and so that's why I felt that it was relevant and important to single out this group, and also because the impact of things like structural adjustment programs and these kind of more macro issues do seem to fall disproportionately on the backs of women rather than men. So your man, of course, is also working with no protective clothing, lacquering the boxes in the example you gave, but he isn't also going home and having to look after the kids and walk to go and get the water and do all these other things as well. So I think that's why it's relevant to also to single out women in this. And the issue about whether... it's where my handwriting is getting incredibly bad. is this going to affect... is this gender mainstreaming approach going to reduce the impact, the negative effects of globalization, I think was your question, only in developing countries or also in developed countries? Was that roughly the question? Yeah. There's a very long way we have to go, as we've already discussed and as Anne raised, here in the developed world as well, too, in terms of reaching anything that is remotely approximating equality. And you know, I think it, you know, it depends really how seriously policymakers in countries really address these issues as to how real the impact is going to be and how different the results. I mean, you know, for example, if we do look at the gender effects of trade policies, that is going to have ramifications both for developed countries and developing countries. If we look at elasticities of trade elasticities on kind of gender dimensions, for example, looking at women's education and the relationship to working conditions and wages, and also on the relationship between imports, rise in imports, and how that affects women's kind of industries at home and their purchasing power. I mean, all of these things will have implications, I think, for the developed as well as the developing world.
Well, before we start, just three brief points, announcements. One is the series of American Power in the 21st Century begins on January the 22nd here in the Old Theatre at 6:30. Joe Nye from Harvard will be talking about the paradox of American power. Secondly, sorry, for those invited to the reception afterwards, it's on the fifth floor of this building. I'm sorry we can't extend that to all of you, but you'll be there in spirit, if not actually. And finally, I would like to thank three people this evening for a superb lecture and engaging discussion. I'd obviously like to thank the speakers very much, Narina, for two fantastic lectures, and for commenting. But I'd also like to thank Aisha Kaya, who's helped me organize these lectures, and without her help, they would nothing like as be as good as they have been. So thank you, Aisha.